This is an RNZ podcast.
After the announcement of a summit in Paris next month and a yet-to-be-released Christchurch call for action on social media extremism, plenty of pundits here have predicted it's doomed to fail. They've pointed out that the titanic tech companies that run and profit from the popular global online platforms are based in the US, where they have successfully staved off meaningful regulation so far, and the First Amendment backstops freedom of expression. Writing on the spin-off website, Internet New Zealand's chief executive Jordan Carter said this.
The nature of their black and white constitutional protections on free speech in the US and the current state of their politics don't leave me with any confidence that they'll be able to drive change in this area.
And local tech expert and journalist Bill Bennett seemed to agree on News Talk ZB last Wednesday.
The problem with the US is they've got two things which would stop them from acting. One is they have the First Amendment, which is all about freedom of speech, and the second thing is there's something called Section 230, which is in effect, a law which gives social media companies an out. It means that they're not responsible for stuff that other people publish on their sites.
But what's Section 230 when it's at home? Well, it's a provision that's been right at home in US law since 1996 in the Communications Decency Act, much to the relief of online entrepreneurs. It immunises internet services from liability for third-party content, and in the years that the internet has become a huge and far-reaching business, it's become a crucial and highly lucrative shield that's protected online companies from punishing lawsuits. And if Section 230 is new to you, well, last month, NPR in the US clearly reckoned that the same applied to its audience over there.
It's possible you've never heard of Section 230, and yet your life online has likely been shaped by this landmark law. It's described by many as a core pillar of internet freedom, and its history runs through some of the darkest corners of the web.
Now, those dark corners of the web is what we're now so worried about, with extremism and more, as NPR went on to explain.
Section 230 is also tied to some of the worst stuff on the internet, protecting sites when they host revenge porn, extremely gruesome videos, violent death threats. These days, it even connects to the outcry over Russia's role in the election. Section 230 sits at the heart of a major question about the internet today, which is how much responsibility should fall to online platforms for how their users act and get treated.
Growing scepticism about the internet has now placed Section 230 immunity in regulator sites, says NPR. And this peaked recently when an internet advertising site called Backpage was taken to court for offering underage sex, but it used Section 230 to wriggle off the hook and avoid prosecution. Section 230 has turned into a Teflon shield, not to protect free speech, but to protect business revenue, said one journalist following the story of a girl forced into prostitution this way, whose family had tried to prosecute Backpage. So the issue now is how much websites are really involved in or connected with illegal or immoral content created by their users, similar to the distinction between the publisher and the postman raised by Jacinda Ardern after the Christchurch mosque attacks. And a senator who helped draft the original Section 230, Ron Wyden from Oregon, told NPR this week that the likes of Google, Facebook and Twitter must now wield the sword themselves to cut out criminal stuff from their services or risk losing their shield in the Communications Decency Act.
The technology companies do not wake up to their responsibilities and use the power 230 gives them to better protect the public against sex trafficking and countries that try to hack our political system.
Senator Wyden recently said that he said this directly to Facebook's deputy Sheryl Sandberg and Twitter's boss Jack Dorsey. So is the outcome of an argument playing out in the US right now over this, and not a set-piece summit in France which will attract cameras and hit the headlines, the thing that will really determine whether the internet giants now take responsibility for extreme content on their platforms? I asked internet lawyer Rick Shearer from the Auckland firm Lowndes Jordan, who's a board member of NetSafe and Internet New Zealand, and also a member of the informal group that Jacinda Ardern consulted last month before she made the plans for a Christchurch call and a summit in Paris.
There is a very high bar in terms of any interference with free speech for companies in the United States. And that comes out of the First Amendment in their constitution and, as you say, flows into a section which was passed in 1996, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. It's a pretty blunt tool, and of course I mentioned 1996. The internet's changed quite a lot since 1996. And I'm not sure that the original creators of Section 230, one of whom, Ron Wyden, is still around in terms of Congress, really would accept that the complete shield which it provides for online interactive services providers, as they're referred to, is appropriate where you've got these types of platforms providing services which are much more akin to publishers and editors in the old mainstream media. That's why I say I think that having New Zealand and France as a European country is interesting, because if we were to try to align with the United States, we are going to come up against that quite large stumbling block in terms of making any inroads. But what is interesting, I think, is that the whole basis of Section 230 was founded on the assumption that as a platform you get some protection from liability for what third parties might post on your platform, provided that you maintain some sort of standards.
Yeah, and I guess that the creators of Section 230 could not have anticipated that some of these businesses, the likes of Facebook and Google, would become epic, you know, huge, huge companies. Whereas, I mean, they would have been concerned back in the day, presumably, about, you know, that lawsuits could crush an online startup when there wasn't so much money in the business.
You're exactly right that these organisations have become bigger. But I think the other interesting thing is how they monetize information and ensure that we stay on the platform so that they can increase the monetization has certainly changed. You know, when you're talking about an algorithm which effectively decides what you and I see, and obviously you and I will see very different things depending on how we interact with these platforms, that to me doesn't sound too different from being a publisher.
Yeah, I see you've actually made that comment in an online debate. The algorithms whose main purpose is to attract and keep our attention are doing the same job, you say, as a traditional mainstream media editor deciding which piece to run on the front page. That's the argument the likes of Macron and Jacinda Ardern are going to have to win in Paris, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it does raise the other issue, which is where these companies are simply saying, look, we're not subject to your jurisdiction. So we're just going to, in a sense, thumb our nose at any pronouncements that you might make in your country, although they will say, look, we will abide by local laws. When the rubber really hits the road, you often see, you know, objections to jurisdiction being taken. So I think that is one area that we've seen put front and centre in Europe, where Europe has said, look, if you target people in Europe or you have some business connection with Europe, our laws are going to apply. And by the way, those significant fines, 4% of global revenue, are going to apply to you no matter where you are. That's not new, those sorts of ideas. Tax law does similar things. Once we get to that level, an international comity, if that's what we can achieve, driven by France and New Zealand, will start to flow into local forms of legislation with an international set of principles, and then bringing it home to various countries, whether that be through law or through rulemaking, may actually achieve it. So the fact that companies which are situated in the United States and are therefore subject in their own jurisdiction to free speech and Section 230 may not make as much difference as some people might think.
But indeed, even in the US, the Section 230 seems to be in play. I mean, that's kicked off a bit of a debate. Law professors like Eric Goldman, for example, saying, well, actually, this doesn't necessarily mean that if that shield is dropped, that the First Amendment standards will fill in to protect the rights of, you know, the ordinary users. So this is a big live debate now. Does a lot actually hinge on not what's said in Paris or how great the international agreement could be there, but actually whether US lawmakers have the stomach for hitting the online companies by removing their legal protections in the US?
Yeah, I think the debate in the US will be anything, and Section 230 is an example, which traverses into free speech and First Amendment protections, has huge, huge vested interests on all sides of that debate, whether it be from the Electronic Freedom Foundation on one side and ACLU and people of that nature.
Yeah, they want a free and open internet for the users.
And they object to any dilution of the protections given by Section 230 and over the top of that, the First Amendment. We all, of course, we subscribe to international treaties and we have our own Bill of Rights, which safeguards freedom of speech and freedom of expression and freedom of association. But subject to limitations, which are, you know, appropriate in a free and fair democratic society. And it's that part of it, the sword or the shield, depending on which way you look at it, which seems to be missing from the debate. As I say, I think if you can find international agreement, whether it be with or without the United States, we may be able to move around some of those issues that challenge the United States whenever they're looking at these sorts of problems. Having these organisations front up and commit to things is good, and we want to see that, and we want to see them enforce their own rules, which, of course, at the moment, you know, if you look at the terms of service of these various organisations, would enable them to do anything that we want and more. It's not that they don't have the rules, it's just that they don't really enforce them. And one of the problems that is often raised is that these organisations have become so big. I guess I don't have too much sympathy with that argument, because the idea that I've become too big to abide by appropriate rules that might have been easier to abide by when I was small doesn't seem to me to be a very, very appropriate argument. If you're going to get big, then you have to build in that. And when you're making a lot of money in not doing so, then I don't have a hell of a lot of sympathy.
And finally, Rick, I mean, you're speaking to us here as an internet and digital business lawyer, a specialist in that field and a partner at Lowndes Jordan, but you are also a member of an advisory group to advise the Prime Minister on this after the Christchurch mosque attacks. Have you had to tell her and other people who are involved in this that, you know, certain things just simply may not be achievable?
Yeah, I am a member of that group. I can't obviously speak for the group, and we've only met once, and that was really just a scoping meeting. I'm not sure where the group is going to go. I'm keen to be involved. My comments are public.
I mean, have you had to say to officials and indeed to the Prime Minister, well, you know, good luck with that, because they'll fight it tooth and nail based on their past record and only give a little ground if they really think they have to?
I mean, I think their attitudes to those sorts of things are public as well, so I don't need to say that. I think that the idea of New Zealand and France coming together to create a platform for other countries to join in arriving at some form of international committee on some principles that we all agree to, not a treaty, because I think a treaty would take too long and is too difficult, but certainly some statements which I don't think anyone would disagree with. And I'm particularly glad in this context that we are sticking to violent extremism and terrorism, because I think once you go wider than that into things like fake news and democratic damage and wider forms of online harm, it becomes very difficult. And the issues we've discussed before about freedom of speech and the US perspective on that really start to challenge the ability to actually make some gains. And I think we do need to make some gains in these areas. But it may not, if the target is narrow, then it may be easier to make those gains, because it's very hard for anyone to disagree with that as a principle.
Do you think it would be interesting, Rick, to be in Paris to see the politicians talking about and chewing over all these issues, or as a lawyer, you think, I'll leave the politics to the politicians and I'll get involved when it becomes a legal issue?
I don't expect that I'm going to get a trip to Paris, but it is a point in time. You do see, you know, with the internet and the development of the internet, Section 230, for example, being an example, the DMCA and in the copyright area being another one, you do see points in time where radical change happens, not necessarily radical in the sense of great, massive, great new laws, but certain principles that flow through into the regulation of the online environment do come up every now and again, and I suspect this is one time.
That was internet lawyer Rick Shearer from the firm Lowndes Jordan, who's also a member of the informal group that Jacinda Ardern consulted with last month before she made her plans for a Christchurch call and a summit on social media in Paris.